Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg. Hello, welcome back to Roots of Magic. This is Earl Fontenelle, and today we're delighted to welcome back to Roots of Magic Daniel Schwemer. As keen listeners will know, an Assyriologist and Hittitologist at the University of Würzburg with a special interest in magic, a man who's edited and published a huge number of important texts from the ancient Near East, and today is here to talk about yet another important ancient magical text that he's just about to publish an edition of, something known as Bit Messeri, or the House of Enclosure. Daniel, thank you for coming back on Roots of Magic. It's delightful to see you.
Thank you for having me back, Earl. It's great to be here again.
So, in our recent interview with Beatrice Baradli, we talked about our old friend the Ashipu, this magical practitioner who isn't exactly a priest, but isn't exactly a magician. He's a very special character. And he does a number of protective and other practices, including something called Bit Rimki, which we talked about in that episode. But now we're talking about something else, Bit Messeri, a ceremonial protective ritual for the protection of houses, attested especially in manuscripts from the great library of Ashurbanipal. And a really important ritual for the ancient Babylonian Assyrian folks. So how would you introduce Bit Messeri to the woman in the street who's never heard of it before?
Yeah, you mentioned Bit Rimki, the ritual you discussed with Beatrice, which has a very similar name, but is a very different ritual, actually. The Babylonians apparently recognized that they had similar names in a catalog of important texts of the Ashipu. They put them side by side, but they are very, very different texts. With Beatrice, you talked about this royal ritual for the purification of the king. And Bit Messeri is nothing like that in many ways. It's really something that is well known to us to this day, that people feel most protected when they're at home, in their house, in their flat, where they can close the door and everything foreign and evil threats are kept out, and you're safe at home. And I think that is a feeling that to all of us is very familiar. The home as a safe place where the family, we as humans in groups, live together and are protected from any possible threats from the outside world. And in all religions, there are symbols, amulets that you can use to protect a house, a flat, if you only think about the evil eye that you see everywhere hanging on doors. And for Babylonians, the protection of the human habitation was also a key component of any religious and magical rites. And there are amulets, there are different kinds of rituals for protecting a house. And Bit Messeri is one of them and stands out because it's a very ceremonial, very extensive ritual, which basically had just this simple purpose to protect a patient, his family, and the house where they were living from an evil threat. And in the case of Bit Messeri, it was not just something that you did every day or that was present all the time. It was performed when really an acute threat was being felt by the patient or the family. It's actually not described in detail in the text, but it seems that repeated unexpected deaths in the family were something where you would think, oh dear, we are really under threat. Something very dangerous is going on. And this was interpreted as an attack of multiple demons that had taken over the house. So you were not safe anymore in your house. And that was an occasion when you would contact an Ashipu, this ritual expert, that was typically an occasion where this ritual would have been chosen to purify the house, protect it, drive out the evil forces, and protect it from any future attacks. That's the basic, simple purpose of it. So in principle, it is in terms of its objective, it's a very simple ritual.
Okay. But it's not so simple maybe in the implementation.
No.
Why? Yes, we'll see. So things are going wrong. You decide you need to do this house protection ritual. Are things going wrong because they just are? Or are things going wrong maybe because of the attack of a witch or evil practitioner or hostile practitioner or demons? Maybe the people in the house did something to anger the gods. Like, what do we know about the kind of etiology, the thinking behind why this is happening to us, that we need to do this ritual?
Yeah, in principle, there are these different etiologies that were available to the Archipu experts. So, of course, an attack by evil rituals performed by a witch was a possible source of possible threat to a house, or specific demons or transgressions of the humans who lived in the house, or their forebears that had caused the anger of a deity. All this is possible. It seems that the hypothesis, the ritual hypothesis of this ritual Beit Meseri, House of Enclosure, is that what is threatening this family, the patient and his house, is really a gang of demons that are largely anonymous but are sort of hidden in every crack of the mud brick walls of this house and have to be driven out. It's at the same time not one personalized, clearly identified, described demon who would be addressed as an individual, so that we don't have that. And at the same time, it's a multitude. It seems to be many, many demons that are threatening the patient. And that seems to be the special profile, the special hypothesis, so to say, of this ritual, that this is what has to be, what the house has to be defended against.
Right. I suppose that could also be what makes it a general use ritual. We don't even know which demon or demons this is. We're just going to say all of them, right? And that way, if it's one demon, if it's five, if it's a huge multitude, whatever it is, you've got them all under your rubric and you're just doing a general no demons allowed sort of force field, right? Now, before we get into this ritual itself, the really fascinating stuff, let's talk about the dates for which this ritual is attested. If you could give an idea of who the people doing this ritual were. Were they Sumerians? Does it come from those ancient people, the Sumerians, or is it much later? Like, who and when are using this?
Yeah, if you have a glance at the incantations of Beit Meseri without any preconceptions, you would think, oh, this must be very ancient. It's all in Sumerian. All these recitations are in Sumerian, the earliest language and traditional sacred language of Mesopotamia. But when you look more closely, then it becomes clear that this ritual was composed in the form that we know it much later. And the manuscripts that we know, so the cuneiform clay tablets, they come from both northern and southern Mesopotamia, both Assyria and Babylonia. The earliest manuscripts are no earlier than the 7th century BC. And they come, as you mentioned in your introduction, and many of them come from the library that the new Assyrian king Ashurbanipal assembled in Nineveh. A few others come from another Assyrian capital, Ashur, from a private library of an Archipu expert. But at the same time, we have manuscripts from the Mesopotamian south, from Babylonia, but they all date even later. So they date to the Achaemenid and even Seleucid periods, and come from places like Uruk, Sippar, Babylon, from various contexts, both probably temple libraries and private libraries of ritual experts like the Archipu. And the question, of course, is always, on the one hand, we have the manuscript transmission, and that gives us certainly the point of time at which this ritual must have existed when it was copied by scribes. But of course, that doesn't give us the answer to the question of when was this ritual actually composed. Is it much, much older and only attested to us in first millennium manuscripts? And when we look at both the linguistic form of the Sumerian and Akkadian recitation texts, most of them are actually in Sumerian, and at the theological contents of the ritual, the ideas that are used in that ritual. Then we can actually see that the Sumerian that is used there is not the Sumerian of the early second millennium or even earlier. It is a very artificial Sumerian as it was used in the first millennium by people who basically learned Sumerian at university, and used it in practice. But these are not old traditional texts. They use traditional motifs, they use traditional phrases, but on the whole, you can see that they are the product of a learned tradition of the probably early first millennium. And that ties in, and that's maybe something we can discuss later also in detail, with the theology of this ritual, where we can actually, I think, argue that this is a ritual that in the form that is best known to us, it might have existed in other forms earlier, but in the form that is best known to us, a very ceremonial, very extensive form, it presupposes theological thoughts that are expressed in the Babylonian Epic of Creation, in the Enuma Elish, that are expressed in the Era Epic. So mythological compositions that we know do not predate the first millennium by a lot. They come from the Enuma Elish, probably comes from the late second millennium. The Era Epic, most people assume, is later, 9th century or 8th century. And I would argue that Bit Mesari is a ritual that was probably composed in Babylonia, in the Mesopotamian south, maybe in the 9th, maybe in the 8th century, using traditional materials, and that it apparently quickly became very prominent, very popular, because it was adopted by the scholars of Ashurbanipal, and then it continued to be transmitted almost to the end of the cuneiform script. Of course, we never know exactly when the last scribe now copied Bit Mesari for the last time, but it apparently became part of the canon of the Ashipu very quickly then, throughout the first millennium.
Got it. I would love to return to the theological presuppositions there. What is the kind of religious worldview of the people doing it? But before we do that, maybe let's address the heart of the matter. What does it look like? So I'm asking for a friend. My buddy, a lot of bad stuff's been happening in his house recently. It so happens he lives in a mud brick dwelling, and he feels like he needs to get an Ashipu to sort it out. He thinks demons are messing with him. What does he do, and what happens next?
What should he do? Yeah, what is actually happening if an Ashipu performs Bit Mesari? In this extensive form, your friend will have to invest 4 days. This is not something you can do on afternoon. It takes several days.
Yeah, like a lot of the canon that we have from Near Eastern ritual, right? It's labor intensive. I wonder if, does he have to invest some money as well? Is the Ashipu saying, okay, but you have to pay me? How does the Ashipu get paid?
Yeah, if he's not the king of Assyria and has any Ashipu anywhere in his service, your friend, then I think he will have to invest, because it's not only the Ashipu's working time, the Ashipu needs helpers, and the Ashipu has also to bring animals, various materials, and so on. There are offerings that are to be brought. So your friend has to invest a few goats and sheep and other things to make this happen. So it's not a ritual for poor people. There were reduced, cheaper, so to say, versions that you could do. But what we're talking about today is a ritual for someone who belongs to the urban elite and can invest in his own health, the health of his house, and the house of health of his family. So he needs 3 to 4 days, and then he will invite the Ashipu and his team to his house. They will work there for the duration of the ritual. And actually, the first 2 days are spent on preparations, because this house has to be ritually reconquered in a way. It has to be equipped, most of its walls and doors have to be equipped with ritual paraphernalia. And this is what is happening during the first 2 days, because these paraphernalia are actually produced within the ritual. So on the first day, in the morning, the ritual expert arrives and a room is picked in the house whose door points towards sunrise, towards the east. And this room then is the main room of the ritual, which is then called the bedroom. And in this room, a bed is set up for the patient. And it forms, for the ritual purposes, now the center of the house. And what is being done over the first 2 days is preparing representations of the protective spirits, protective forces that will fight the evil demons. Those representations are prepared and set up, basically. And it begins with, and what is so fascinating about this ritual is that really over these 2 days, a whole mythological world is set up like a stage around the patient. So we're not only talking about more than 100 figurines that are being produced, but also, and that is something that unfortunately is not preserved at all anywhere in that sense, because everything is removed at the end of the ritual. So even if we found a house where this ritual was performed, we wouldn't see it. But what is being done is that the walls of the inside walls of this ritual bedroom and the outside walls of the house to a certain extent, and especially the door of the bedroom and the main entrance to the house, they are all receive wall paintings of protective spirits. So that is the first step. The Ashipu begins to paint your house with protective spirits of various kinds. So you live in a different house all of a sudden from day one onwards. And then the Ashipu also goes out and procures materials for preparing figurines, different types of wood, one type of wood, tamarisk wood, that is thought to be very pure, from which purifying spirits are produced, and then a kind of ash wood probably, which is a hard wood that was used for sticks and weapons. And from this, very warlike protective spirits are representations of them, figurines of them are produced. And then also clay is procured, and the Ashipu forms a number of figurines from clay. And this is happening in three major excursions outside the city to a grove where you have tamarisk trees. And then little rituals are performed there outside in the grove for procuring the wood in the right manner. And then the wood is taken back to the house. And then, for example, from the tamarisk wood, figurines of bird-headed primeval sages are formed that have buckets in their hand and purify the patient. And seven of them are carved and then set up. And for 2 days, this is happening until the whole house is peopled, so to say, with figurines that surround the bed of the patient in the bedroom, that stand at the doorways, and wall paintings that you have in the bedroom and around the doors and on the outside walls. And this really takes 2 days, the first half of the ritual. And the third day then of the ritual is the main day for the ritual performance. And it basically, to a large part, consists of addressing all these various groups of protective spirits with incantations, many of them Sumerian, and inviting them to fight for the patient, to purify the patient, to protect his house. That is happening over the third day. There are also offerings. You have to open the mouth of these figurines, first of all. So there is a series of rites going on. And then the next major part is the night from the third day to the fourth day, where you bring offerings to an astral deity called Lugal-Ira, about whom we should talk, really. He is unexpected in a way. He's not one of the major Babylonian gods. And then on the final day, on the fourth day in the morning with sunrise, you are being told, or your friend is being told by the Ashipu, yeah, all these spirits now have defeated the demons and they are gone. And then all the figurines are taken out. The walls are wiped clean. You bring offerings to the rising sun god, and your house has been protected. It has been enclosed during that ritual time. all the demons have been driven out, and the enclosure, by setting up all these figurines and protecting the doorways, will then also protect you from future attacks. That's the basic idea. Okay. So it takes 4 days almost.
When you say opening the mouth, now that's a term I know from Egyptian statue animation practices. Is that actually the term that is used in the Mesopotamian context?
Yeah, that is a close parallel.
How interesting.
Between the Egyptian and Mesopotamian ritual practices. In Mesopotamia, it is really in principle the same. When you use statues, figurines in a ritual context, you will at one point initiate them, turn them from wooden figurines into acting participants of the ritual. And in Bit Mesari, as also in other rituals, for that the so-called mouth opening rite is used, which is a standard rite of the Ashipu. In Bit Mesari, it's actually not described at all in detail. They just say on the morning of the third day, you bring all the figurines up to the roof, bring an offering to the rising sun god, and then you open the mouth of the figurines. And then you take them down to the bedroom. So they don't describe it in detail. And that is one of our problems. It's actually never described in detail because it's such a standard rite. But probably the Ashipu touches the mouths of the figurines with a sweet confection, and so that they begin to sort of taste something, and that triggers them to open their mouth.
That's extraordinary that there's that commonality of thinking across the Egyptian and Near Eastern religious mindset. Cool. The buckets you mentioned, are they these sort of handbags, the sort of woven handbags that we talked about with Frank Simons? Listeners, go to our episode with him. There's a god, a bearded fellow with four wings holding one of these handbags. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, indeed. That's exactly the same. What Frank was probably talking about are these representations, mainly on the reliefs of Neo-Syrian palaces, where you have monumental representations of protective spirits that have usually in their left hand this bucket or handbag, as you say, citula, if you want to be posh, filled with water, and in their right hand different kinds of plant elements, basically an aspergillum, with which they sprinkle the water from the bucket. Yeah.
The pine cone.
And a pine cone and other plant items, but very often a pine cone, And in Bit Mesari, there are seven groups of seven primeval sages, or in Akkadian, Apkalu, of seven Apkalu sages, so in total 49 Apkalu sages that are deployed against the demons, partly painted, partly as figurines. And they are subdivided again in three groups that are purifying, three groups that are warlike and fighting, and one group that is outside the house on the four corners of the house and round the door, three on the door, two on the doorposts, one on the lintel. And the three purifying groups, so these three times seven purifying Apkalu sages, they carry these buckets and the pine cone and purify the patient. Two of these groups are painted on the back wall of the bedroom to protect him, so say from behind in the back part of the room. And one of them is carved from tamarisk wood, a group of seven with bird heads. And there are three types that are used in Bit Mesari. One type of Apkalu sage has a bird head, actually a vulture head. And listeners may have seen that on Neo-Syrian reliefs. The most famous form is the fish Apkalu, which is a mixture of the Euphrates carp and a human. The carp Apkalu also is also used. And then there's the fully anthropomorphic Apkalu that Frank referred to. And all three types are employed, and all three types occur, once with weapons and once with purifying items.
Now, These Apkalu, you refer to them as sages. And maybe this brings us now into the realm of theology, the belief about what kind of spirits exist and stuff like that. But if they're sages, does that mean they're like ancient humans, human sages? Or are they, were they never humans? Are they spirits?
Well, that's an easy and difficult question at the same time. These sages are non-human, but they are also not just gods. They are divine beings that live at the court of the god of wisdom and exorcistic law, Enki in Sumerian, Ea in Akkadian, who lives in the subterranean ocean. And at his court, as part of his court, he has these sages. And in the traditional transmission in Babylonia, these were seven sages at the court of the god of wisdom. And one of them is the most important of them, the leader of these Apkalu sages. He's called Uana in Bitmeseri. And that is the same figure that we also encounter in the Greek History of Babylonia by Berossos, in the Greek version as Oanes. That's actually the same name. And he's the sage of Ea in the subterranean ocean. And he and his colleagues are not human, but part of the divine world, but they have an important mediator function between the divine wisdom and human arts and trades and human knowledge. And that is the story that we so far, unfortunately, only know from Berossos, that at the beginning of history, this Oanes came up from the Persian Gulf, a monster, it is said in Berossos, with a fish head and so on. So that is one of our carp Apkalus, actually, came up from the sea and taught humankind everything that was to know at the beginning of history. And all knowledge that we have, in the end, goes back to the divine knowledge of Enki Ea, mediated by the Apkalu sages. But the human ritual experts, like our Ashipu who is performing this ritual, or the very learned Ashipu who composed Bitmeseri, they actually see themselves in one line of tradition right back to Enki Ea, because what they are using, what they are, the knowledge they are employing in their rituals is what was in the beginning transmitted by the Apkalus. And this line of transmission is very clear in certain catalogs where you have lists of the Apkalus of divine origin, which are followed by sages of human origin, or sages that are two-thirds divine and one-third human. So they saw a direct line passing down to their own tradition from these divine Apkalus from ancient primeval times. But in Bitmeseri, these primeval Apkalus are evoked and come back and protect the patient. But they are the models, the origin of tradition of the Ashipu who is actually himself performing the ritual.
Right. That's brilliant. One of the things that I find very fascinating in the study of culture is when you have, as you almost always do, the gods at one end of a spectrum and humans at the other end of a spectrum, there's always someone in the middle mediating, or often someone in the middle mediating. For the Greeks, it's daimones. But the way that those mediating entities are conceived of is always a very interesting cultural phenomenon. And the way in which, or the degree to which, let's say, the spectrum from gods to humans is a continuum rather than a broken chain, you know. And here you can see continuum, at least in the sense of the job description of the Ashipu. He's like, well, I'm doing this job, and if you trace my kind of trade lineage back, you're going to end up at Ea, but first, you know, via Fishhead, Oanes, and his various colleagues and stuff like that. So we're all working for one firm, as it were, and Ea is at the top. He's the CEO, and then there's like middle management, which is the sages, and then we're the sort of on the ground workers.
Yeah, you get several ways of identifying with this knowledge or original knowledge of Enki Ea. On the one hand, we have this line of tradition with the Apkalus that are deployed. On the other hand, in one of the Sumerian incantations, the Ashipu is mentioned himself after a long description of the various figurines that he has put up and the images that he has set up in the house. And then the Ashipu himself is mentioned in the incantation that he himself recites. And the incantation says, yeah, and the Ashipu expert, our ritual expert who is performing here the ritual, he is the image of Asaluchi. He's the figurine of Asaluchi. And Asaluchi, or Marduk, is in Babylonian mythology the son of Enki-Ea, and he's the one who's actually performing all the rituals in the divine world on a mythological level. He's the one who goes out, performs the rituals that Enki-Ea invented, so to say. Also has to go back to his father, asking him for advice. So on that level, in this incantation, the Ashipu performing the ritual is also directly identified with what is happening on a divine level. Among all these figurines, he's actually the acting Ashipu, and not only the human Ashipu, but also the image of the divine Ashipu, the son of Enki-Ea himself. So there are all kinds of ways of connecting to this tradition that are actually in this ritual spelled out in many other rituals. These ideas were also present in the attire of the Ashipu and so on. But here it's actually spelled out and said in the incantations. I think also an indication that this is a late learned ritual where these things are made explicit rather than just understood.
Yeah, maybe even some kind of theological interpretation is going on, right?
Yeah.
Where if we imagine rituals like this coming from more kind of fundamental human patterns of cognition and thinking and association, and you know, doing a ritual doesn't always imply a theory, or at least not a theory that's been spelled out, but just an intuitive kind of grasp of the world you live in and how things are related in unseen ways. But this is someone making it explicit, going like, ah, so this actually, what the Ashipu is doing here is he's kind of like the statues, the activated statues. He's different, but he's functioning
alive,
in a
he's
similar
a live
way.
He's a live figurine, yeah.
He's a live figurine.
Yeah, I entirely agree that this is very typical for Vietmesri, that these things are thought about, interpreted, and then explicitly mentioned in the incantations, some of these interpretations are understandable to the patient when it's recited in Akkadian, the language that would have sounded archaic to a first millennium patient, but he still would have understood it. But some of it recited in Sumerian, so our patient wouldn't have understood a word.
He would have understood, this is power language, this is God language. Like, he would have got that signification for sure.
He would have
right?
got that. He would have understood some of the famous names of the Apkalus, but he wouldn't have understood the details of arguments that are being made in these texts. And that was really for the Ashipu himself, who composed this text to really spell out why he's performing it in this way and why this makes sense, how this fits into the cosmos and theology of his time.
Well, you mentioned Marduk, so I feel like it's time to talk about the cosmos and theology of the time now. What is the kind of broader theological context? The term theological brings with it a kind of freight of sort of notions from medieval Christianity and stuff like that. But in terms of just what kinds of gods, what kind of world is this ritual taking place in? What are the relevant unseen powers that are being negotiated? Because I know Marduk is, there's a sort of process of Mardukization that goes on, isn't there, in later, in sort of is it properly Babylonian?
Yeah,
the importance
first millennium
of Marduk.
Babylonia. And that is a development that reaches far back into the second millennium, but is fully in blossom, so to say, in the first millennium. Marduk of Babylon is recognized not only as the god of the capital Babylon, but also as the king of the gods. And the Enuma Elish, a learned poem that describes how Marduk rose to power, probably originating in the second half of the second millennium, describes him not only as king of the gods, but also as creator of the world. and as God of the gods, the gods almost literally say, you are for us what we are for humans, basically. So he has a very, very prominent position. And that is particularly relevant for our ritual texts, because Marduk, and this is also a development that dates much earlier than the first millennium, Marduk was identified with Asaluchi, the traditional god of exorcism and son of Enki, or Ea in Akkadian. So Marduk / Asaluchi, Asaluchi, the Sumerian son of Enki from the town of Enki in Eridu and the traditional Ashipu expert of the gods, becomes identified with Marduk. So in the first millennium for Babylonians, Marduk is not only the king of the gods, but also at the same time, the son of the god of wisdom, Enki Ea, and the most prominent divine ritual expert, the divine Ashipu expert. And so Marduk plays an eminent role in this ritual tradition. He's one of the three main gods that an Ashipu would typically invoke in his rituals. There's of course Enki Ea, the father of Asaluchi Marduk, and then there's also Shamash, the sun god in Sumerian Utu, who is also very often invoked, and the rising sun is an important symbol of delivery in the morning from the evils that beset you at night, etc., etc. So these three gods are really important and come up again and again in Ashiputu rituals. And what is actually surprising about Beit Meseri is that these three gods are mentioned, they occur, and the first prayer is addressed to Marduk, but then they disappear, sort of. Well, they receive offerings every day, but when we look at the prayers that are recited in the course of this ritual, then of course we have all these incantations addressed to the various protective spirits, and we have prayers to deities. And the opening prayer is to Marduk, but then we have three more prayers addressed to deities, and not a single of them is addressed to either Ea or Shamash or Marduk, or actually any of the other great gods of the Babylonian pantheon. And that was something that I always found extremely odd, I must say, but then never thought about it. Only when I began really working on this text, editing it, I thought I must explain why this strange god, Lugal-Ira, who is not important at all usually in the Babylonian pantheon, is the main god of this ritual and invoked not in one prayer, but in three, and is the main divine addressee of the rites during the night between the third day and the morning of the fourth day. So the central night of the ritual where the demons are finally defeated and brought to the netherworld and made prisoners there, basically. So in a way, you see in Beit Meseri the typical theological world of first millennium Babylonia. Marduk is there, and Shamash and Enki Ea also mentioned. But then there's this Lugal-Ira, who's really unexpected in a way, at least in this prominent role. And when you look into who this Lugal-Ira actually is, it becomes stranger and stranger in a way. Well, it all makes sense in the end. But right. Lugal-Ira right. is a lowly doorkeeper in the netherworld, in the traditional pantheon. He is standing there at the gate of the netherworld and protecting it. And he's warlike and he's terrible. And he has a brother called Meslam-Ta'er, who's also a netherworld god, and stands there and forms with Lugal-Ira a pair of guards at the entrance of the netherworld. And as such, they are invoked, those two twins, occasionally in magical rituals as protectors of gates. And I think that's how they made their way into Beit Meseri, originally, so to say. Because what you need in a house protection ritual is deities, spirits that protect doorways. And you need a pair of them as guards. And so whom do you pick? Lugal-Ira and Meslam-Ta'er. And this is what you find also in other house protection rituals. But what you do not find is that Lugal-Ira is then invoked in three prayers And is invoked in two of them without his twin brother, alone, on his own. And then in a final prayer together with his twin brother, but still it's Lugal Irra who's calling all the shots, who's most important, and not his brother. And that doesn't fit into the traditional pattern and goes far beyond what we find in other rituals of this type. So the question really is, who is Lugal Irra in Beit Meseri?
Are you going to tell us?
Yeah, I might. I should. Well, my idea is when you look at the prayers for Lugal Irra, he's invoked at night, so he's a nocturnal god. That is not surprising.
The gods of night, right. Now, let me interrupt here, if I may. The gods of night are one of the most interesting facets of Near Eastern religion for me, because it's very unique thing. You know, you don't see it among the Greeks. You don't see it in the same way among the Egyptians. This idea that the planets and stars and things are deities. Is he associated with a heavenly body, first of all?
Yes. Yeah.
Is he a planet?
No, he's Gemini. He's the twin star. So together with Meslamta'ea, Lugal Irra forms Castor and Pollux, basically, and from astronomical texts, it is very likely that Lugal Irra is Castor, whereas Meslamta'ea is Pollux. So they are a constellation. They are the constellation of the twins. They are the twins in the night sky.
Now, let me ask another question, if I may. They're guardians of gates. And when I think of, say, pre-Greek cosmology, you often have two gates to the underworld, one where the sun goes down, and one where the sun comes up. I think for lovers of ancient Greek knowledge, this is probably what the gates in Parmenides' poem are referring to. And you see it in Hesiod as well, the gates of day and night. Are we to take it that each of these twins is assigned to one of those gates? Or is that just my overinterpretation?
We do have this concept that there are two ways to the netherworld, one in the east, one in the west, where the sun rises and the sun sets. The two of them are usually imagined standing at one gate together at the entrance of the netherworld, that is then imagined somewhere in the deep as a city with seven walls and a single gate that leads first into it. So they are imagined as standing side by side on both sides of one gate, usually. And that is also how they are depicted in Beit Meseri at the entrance of the house. There's on the left is Meslamta'ea, and on the right of the gate is Lugal Irra. And that, I think, is the main image that is associated with them.
Got it. Yeah. So the other world can have different gates depending on which way you're approaching it, right?
Yeah.
Considered
which way you...
Astronomically, it might have...
Yeah, indeed. Which way you are... Imagine the underworld at that point, whether you think mainly of it as a city with one entrance, or whether you think of it cosmologically with two areas where the sun rises from and sinks into the netherworld. And here it's more the concept of the netherworld as a big city with a gate that has two guardians who are terrifying and warlike and whom you can deploy for the protection of your own house, ritually. And this is what is happening in Beit Meseri. But this doesn't explain why Lugal Irra is invoked in these prayers on his own. And he's invoked at night, as we would expect, as the twin star. And then when we see how he's described in these prayers, he's actually not described very much as a warrior standing at a door and fighting off the enemies. He's described as a ritual expert who calls together all the gods and assembles them and performs the ritual at night and knows everything that his father Enki Ea told him, etc. So what he is described as actually is a nocturnal version of Marduk, Asaluchi. And in this context, his name is reinterpreted in one of these texts, because his name Lugal Irra actually means strong king, literally in Sumerian. Simply, Lugal is king and Irra is strong. And then he is described, he's invoked, Lugal Irra, you are wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And then he's invoked as Lugal Ira of the gods. In a sentence of this prayer where the text turns from Sumerian into Akkadian. And whenever we have a language switch like that in these texts, something very important is being said, usually in these recitation texts. It's very rare that we have this language switch from Sumerian to Akkadian. And here we have this nonsensical phrase, Lugal Ira of the gods, which doesn't make sense, a name of the gods. But when you translate the name, then it all of a sudden means strong king of the gods. And when a first millennium Babylonian scholar, or actually everyone on the street, thought, if you ask them who's the strong king of the gods, they would not have said Lugal Ira. They would have said Marduk. So what we see in these prayers is that Lugal Ira is making an unexpected career, so to say, for one night. He's becoming a nocturnal Marduk or Asaluchi, and he's performing the ritual. And then in the second prayer, he's described as a universal ruler who is so powerful and rules the netherworld and the upper world, and therefore more powerful than all the demons. And that again connects him with Marduk. So Lugal Ira is identified with Marduk, but that is not all. At the same time, he's also, in some of these prayers, then at least implicitly, identified with another divine king, the god Nergal, who is the king of the netherworld, according to Babylonians, while Marduk is the king of the upper world. And Lugal Ira is anyway a god of the netherworld, so it's not surprising, but he's also identified with his boss, usually, so to say, the king of the netherworld. So he becomes really a universal god who rules everything, the upper world, the netherworld. He's Nergal, he's Marduk. And another main, now it becomes very confusing, but please bear with me, another name of the king of the netherworld, Nergal, is the god Ara, a god of disease and war, and who's identified with Nergal as king of the netherworld. And Lugal Ira, you can read as strong king. But Lugal Ira also sounds very, very much like Lugal Ara, King Ara. So the ruling god Ara. And then we can see that when we know that, once we realize that, you can see that in some passages, Lugal Ira is also identified with this other form of the king of the netherworld, the god Ara. And this takes another turn, because Ara, in the Ara epic, which is a learned Babylonian myth that was composed early in the first millennium, this Ara epic has an epilogue. It describes the god Ara as deposing Marduk, or stepping in while Marduk is deposed, is not on his throne, and then war breaks out, etc., etc. It's a complicated myth, but at the end there's an epilogue where the composer of the myth says that this myth is good for protecting houses. Put it up in houses as an amulet. So he's not only a universal ruler, Marduk, Asaluchi, Nergal, and Ara, he's also the protective god for houses as which Ara functions. So all this is put together in this one divine figure of Lugal Ira, and that is very, very unusual, even for first millennium Ashiputu rituals. And what makes it even more unusual is that we have this universal god who's alone, basically. There are no other gods that are invoked. There's not a series of great gods that are invoked. And that is and I'm coming to the end, bear with me, and that is really fascinating, because that is something that we can observe in first millennium theology in Mesopotamia, that we have this tendency to conceive of deities in a monistic fashion. One god is most important, and all the other gods can be subsumed in some way under that god. And so Bitmesri, to me, it seems that it reflects this theological tendency that we see also in other compositions, texts of first millennium Babylonia and Assyria.
This is so interesting. But to bring the comparative lens here for a moment, in Egypt, and you have colleagues who will correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me one of the distinctive things about the Egyptian theologies over thousands of years, is on the one hand, thousands of gods, literally, very distinct, with personalities, with images, names, you name it, you know. You could make an encyclopedia of the Egyptian gods and they would all have a very distinctive character and look and everything. On the other hand, there's this tendency to just ram them together at will. So suddenly Osiris is Re, and suddenly Re is this god, and suddenly all the gods are, you know, Thoth, you are all the gods. You know, like this sort of thing happens very freely in Egyptian thinking. Now, I don't know if we can put a date to that in terms of if there's more of it later or anything like that, but it's something I've really noticed about Egyptian theology. Is that less typical of the realm you work in, the Near Eastern, from Sumeria onward, theological tradition? And therefore, is it quite distinctively late? In other words, is this a new and unusual approach to the gods, to be sort of like, and this particular astral god from Gemini is also Nergal and is also Marduk and is, you know, like this sort of mushing the gods together.
Yeah. Well, it's both. It's an ancient tradition. You find it from very early on that certain gods are put together in groups, and you find god lists where you basically have the information that the warrior god A, B, and C from the cities A, B, and C are actually the same god. He's only worshipped under different names in these different cities. That is something that happens from very early on, that in a typological way, certain gods and goddesses are put in groups, and certain gods and goddesses are conceived of as being the local manifestation of the same deity, and that there's a tendency that on the one hand you have an ever-expanding pantheon and many, many gods, but then in the systematization of this divine world, there's a reductionist tendency that usually uses typology very much. But before the later second millennium BC in Mesopotamia, we don't see the tendency to really single out one god and describe in very explicit terms that, well, there are all these other gods, of course, but they are the arm and the tongue and the nose and the forehead or whichever part of another god, and they are all consumed in this one god. And that is a tendency that we see from the later second millennium onwards. And we see it in the theology of Marduk, but it's also associated with other deities like Ninurta or Ishtar. We have certain hymnic texts or prayers where they are described as being the only god, really. But it never develops into a really monotheistic theory, as far as we can see. So I would think that in Bitmisri, this is part of a trend that is very much that is a common trend in the thinking of scholars in first millennium Babylonia, that they were very familiar with the idea that actually all these different divine beings can be combined in a certain way, and in a ritual context I can invoke them under one name and create an all-powerful figure out of it. But the fact that you could take Lugal-Ira and turn it into such a figure shows you that it's not yet attached to just one name and there's just one theology. You can be creative to a certain extent with it. So in this sense, in these strong monistic tendencies in theological concepts, that's something that is typical for the first millennium and not earlier periods in Mesopotamia. And it coexists all the time with all these other gods having temples and being evoked in separate prayers and so on. So that it's never followed through in that sense as a theological dogma. So that's very different from later monistic theologies. On the other hand, I find it fascinating to see that this is happening in West Asia around the time where we think that the roots of the great monotheistic religions of West Asia, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, reach back to. These are intellectual developments of the first millennium BC.
Well, let's throw in Mazdaism as well.
Yeah.
Or Zoroastrianism, yes. Right? Which is a monotheizing movement within the... I mean, if we're looking at the Old Avesta, and everyone disagrees on what exactly in the Avesta is the Old Avesta, but there's definitely echoes of a theological worldview very similar to that which is found in the Rig Veda. So this, you know, what they used to call the sort of proto-Aryan or proto-Indo-European mythological worldview. But this, now we suddenly have a figure who's talking with the highest god, getting sort of like in a prophet, what we think of as a prophetic role, long before we get any prophets in Judaism, and reformulating the mythological worldview such that there is a supreme, one supreme good god. You've still got lots of other gods. It's perfectly good to worship them. So it's not monotheism in the sense of ritual must be only and strictly pointed at one god, but I guess what you'd call monistic, more monistic approach. It's saying, no, there is a point to this pyramid of divinities, and it's one guy. Right. So, and that is very much in our thought world in the Near East, especially when we're getting into the Achaemenid era. So between the Jews and the proto-Zoroastrians or Mazdaists, we do indeed have maybe the roots of this monotheist trend. And it's all happening in the right area, right? In the same sort of Near Eastern arena.
Yeah, of course, it's all different and has its own cultural context, but there seems to be this general trend in various places at the same time. And I find it interesting that on the one hand, we have certain concepts that seem to accompany it and also accompany these ideas in Beit Meseri, a dualistic concept. In Beit Meseri, you have the army of evil demons that is defeated by the army, by the one good God. No, I shouldn't say the one good God, but by Lugal Ira and all his helpers. So there is a certain dualism between evil and good, certainly present in that ritual. And at the same time, you have this phenomenon that you have in Beit Meseri one single important deity, and all the other deities really do not play a prominent role for ritual purposes. But at the same time, you have more than 100 protective spirits that are all of a sudden very important and form the, so to say, the army of this god. And that is, again, something that we do not find typically in earlier texts to this extent. We always had one Apkallu sage who is possibly part of a group of seven, yes. But seven times seven? No, only in Beit Meseri. And then there are all these other groups that are multiples of something. And in Beit Meseri, you can see that the Apkallus are really artificially multiplied. You can see that by their names, which are very artificially formed. So he really made an effort to create seven times seven.
Right, like in the angel lists in later magical
traditions. It is very reminiscent of that. And here in Magea, we discussed this one afternoon, and Gideon Bohak, the specialist on Jewish magic, who was with us for half a year, he said, well, this is what I call polyangelic monotheism.
Right. So he
used this term to describe Jewish magical texts, and Beit Meseri is certainly not polyangelic monotheism, but it prefigures concepts like that. And one could think about why this is happening in the first millennium in that part of the world.
Yeah. That's above my pay grade. I mean, I like to observe these things, and it's very important to note, okay, this is new. This is something new that's happening. But then when it gets to why is it happening, I usually shy away. Why do complex changes occur in extremely complex human civilizations? I mean, to take this example, and maybe this is kind of ending our interview on a note of aporia, but there will probably be, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but with Beit Meseri, there probably is some element of just the creative impulse of one individual learned Ashipu who decided to put this ritual into this particular form where it then became canonical. And he may have made some leaps of like, you know what? I think Lugal-era is the nighttime form of Marduk. Boom. We don't know if that was a decision of one person or if it was just some kind of developing cultural consensus. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I entirely agree. Yeah. I would like to discuss this ritual with the chap who composed it, really. I would like to know what he would have more things to explain about it, I'm sure. Because it seems to be the creation of one person. He, of course, had his social context, and he had his teachers. He had the sources that he studied, and all that informs his decisions and how he produces innovative ritual texts in the first part of the first millennium in Babylonia. But I think you're absolutely right. Of course, it doesn't determine everything. There comes this individual part to it, and these decisions are for us. We can observe them, describe them, admire their skill, and hope that they work for the patient. But in the end, of course, other decisions could have been made. What I find suspicious about this whole, as I put it, monistic tendencies that we can observe in various parts and various texts in Mesopotamia at this time is that it's happening at a time when you do politically get the first world empires. These are people who live in political contexts where you could have over two generations or so get the impression that this is actually how the world works. It's ruled by single kings who rule everything, and then they are followed by the next king, or one dynasty is followed by another, and for 100 years it's Babylonians, then these are Assyrians, but it's always this one king. So yeah. I have the suspicion that this informed, this political context informed how one would think of the cosmos and the divine world as well in that period.
Well, it can't be. I think it's, and this is actually old hat in biblical studies, but I don't think it can be a coincidence that it is in this sort of later stratum of the Hebrew scriptures where we start to see God having a throne room full of courtiers of angels who you know, so God has got a throne. He's the king. He has a sort of courtroom. He even has a grand vizier in some tellings, you know, it's be it Metatron or someone else. The divine world very strikingly resembles the political organization of these empires, right?
Yeah, and I would argue Beit Besori is one of the sources where you can see how these thoughts, similar thoughts, could develop that in other areas then led to this kind of description of a single god in Beit Besori. There's no single god, there's no monotheism, of course, but it is part of this broader intellectual climate of the first millennium, I think.
Daniel Schwemer, I'm going to get back to my friend, tell him about this knowledge you've imparted today. He can purify his house. If he can't find an Ashipu, is it okay if I send him to Würzburg and maybe you
please
could...
Please do, we'll try our
you
best.
You could sort him out. You're probably one of the few living people
actually,
who do a credible job.
We're preparing an exhibition as part of our Magea project for the autumn, and we're trying to, well, I'm sure in very imperfect fashion, but we're trying to do a little rebuilding, a little setup of the Beit Besori central ritual room, and have produced figurines and so on. So maybe I can give your friend a course using an actually Beit Besori room later this year.
Right. Brilliant. Well, he'll be very happy about that because, the demons are getting out of hand. Daniel Schwemer, thanks once again for coming back on Roots of Magic. It's been an absolute pleasure, and for expounding this fascinating and multi-layered ritual in its religious context, in its practical context, in its textual context. We look forward very much to the edition coming out. I know you just have to basically do a lot of very accurate drawings of cuneiform tablets, and then we'll see it. Until we speak again, stay magical.